Well, good morning, everybody. We're going to dig right in as the time tends to go by quite quickly. Welcome to the Secular Dharma Foundation Lecture and Dialogue Series. This is our first one. We will be doing one every month of the year, and we're happy to have Stephen here for our first morning to reflect on a few questions. So as it will go is him and I are going to tackle these two questions you might have seen. The first question, what is a secular dharma? And then we'll both respond to a series of questions. And then at the end, hopefully there will be some time left. If you have questions, you can just kind of pop your hand up or write the question in the chat if that feels better for you, and we can take some questions. You will have access to the recording afterwards, both audio and visual. I'll put it back in the Rizuku for you. And we'll take it from there. And just a reminder, if you can, I'm kind of muting you as you come in, but just keep an eye on your mic. Background noises can become quite problematic. So I'll keep an eye on that as well, as I'm both teaching, talking, listening, and moderating the Zoom. And so my internal attention disorder is quite happy today because it gives me multiple things to be dealing with. So that's good. We're not going to talk too much about ourselves. I'm sure you know who we are. If you don't, you can look that up later. But thank you, Stephen, for being here this morning.
Thank you for inviting me and setting this up, Dave. Looking awesome. Forward to it.
Me too. So let's get right into it. Stephen, we'll pass it to you first. What is a secular dharma from the way that you're currently seeing it? I know that the idea has changed for you over time, but could you speak to that for us here this morning?
Okay. Well, welcome everybody. And I don't know if I know any of you. Doesn't really matter. But it's going to be, I think, an interesting conversation that Dave and I are going to initially share with you about our varied perspectives on what a secular approach to the Dharma might be. And Dave has asked me to begin, and I'll speak for about 15 minutes or so, just sketching, as it were, my current take on what this secular approach is. And then Dave will respond, and then we'll go to the next question. I'll say a few words, and then Dave will respond to that, or vice versa, I can't remember. And then hopefully we'll have a good half hour at the end where we can have an open discussion with everybody. So what is a secular approach to the Dharma? And I'm going to actually base this on something I've just written. I'm writing a series of essays at the moment. And one of them, I do in fact address this. I wrote this sometime last week. So this is about as close as you can get to where I currently stand on this question. The key difference, I wrote, between a secular and a religious approach to the Dharma is this. The religious aim to end suffering, while the secular aim to embrace it. Now, I understand that the word religious, even the word secular, when you start prodding at those terms and ask, well, what does that really mean? It becomes a little less obvious. In some ways, I consider myself to be quite a religious sort of person in a broad sense. I identify with religious people, monks and nuns and priests. I feel I'm on the same wavelength. And so in that sense, religious for me means anyone who takes their lives with a kind of ultimate seriousness. That people who are really sort of puzzled and perplexed about what it means to be alive at all. And I imagine that's probably the case for most of you who are listening in and participating in this discussion. But I think I'm using the word here not so much in that sense, but religious in the more popular sense of the word, namely people who have accepted and have come to identify with a particular set of propositions, of views, of beliefs that characterize the religion to which they feel that they belong. And so if you're Christian, you're Christian and you have great faith in God and Christ and so forth, and you adhere to certain religious doctrines that are very important for you. It may be that your religious identity is something you were born into. You didn't choose to become a Southern Baptist. You ended up being born as a Southern Baptist or a Buddhist or a Confucianist or whatever. But religious in that sense is not so much about taking your life with an ultimate seriousness, which you could also apply to certain philosophers and psychologists as well. But it's being religious is because you hold a kind of identity, either by birth or by choice. And that identity has to do with believing certain things. And whatever the evidence might suggest to the opposite, you hold on to those beliefs. And if people disagree with you, then you might get into an argument and try to defend your beliefs against theirs and so on. Well, in this sense, I think we can see in Buddhism, and I'll only really be looking at Buddhism. You can think of Buddhism as a religion, and it clearly is a religion. If you go to Thailand, for example, and you go to a Buddhist temple in the middle of Bangkok, I would challenge any of you to say, well, this is not a religion. It clearly is. It has all of the markers of what we think of as religion. A secular approach, though, is one in which we're not so attached or identified with that religious community or those religious texts or teachers that we've grown up with or we've come to admire. But a secular approach, in a sense, puts the world first, as it were. Seculum in Latin means this age or this time. So a secular approach to the Dharma is one that is, in a sense, putting the emphasis not so much on the past and the doctrines and the beliefs and the stories and the histories and so on of Buddhism or Christianity, but it's an approach to the Dharma that puts the world, puts other people, puts the crisis of the planet in sharper focus and asks, well, how do I respond to that? How do I live in this particular world in which I find myself now in 2025? So the difference between the two, I feel, is that a religious approach is one, certainly for Buddhists, where the aim is actually to bring suffering to an end, to cease the cycle of birth and death. And that, of course, implies belief in life after death. It implies that this is not the only life we'll have. But that, to me, is a belief. It may be true, I've absolutely no idea, but it's not where we would start in our secular approach to the Dharma. Our secular approach would be, first of all, to embrace the suffering, and I'm using this word suffering into a very, very broad sense here, not just in the way that Buddhism defines it, but to embrace life, basically, birth, sickness, aging, and death, the totality of our existence. Religious Buddhists, I then go on to say, think of nirvana as the final cessation of all suffering that is caused by ignorance and craving and reactivity. Whereas secular Buddhists understand nirvana as those moments of non-reactivity that enable a path of human flourishing to come about. So this, I think, for me, at this particular time, I think of a religious Buddhist approach as one that sees the practice of the Dharma as about bringing all suffering to an end, the end of suffering, for which Buddhism is very famous. And I think probably most Buddhists would consider that to just be a very matter-of-fact statement about what it means to be a Buddhist. And therefore, they see the path, the Eightfold Path, as a path that leads us to the ending of suffering. Whereas a secular Buddhist understands nirvana as any moment within our experience in which we find ourselves in a non-reactive space, a non-grasping, a non-fearful, a non-craving kind of state, the kind of state that we settle into each time we meditate, and at the end of the meditation, we say to ourselves, that was a good one. I really touched down deep into myself, into my experience, and I found that non-reactive stillness and quiet and silence. That, to me, is nirvana. It's something we can certainly deepen. It's certainly something we can expand, make more into our daily experience. But it's not something like the nirvana of the religious Buddhist that is some distant goal that we aspire to. It's something that's actually already here. And that non-reactivity, those moments of non-reactivity, are the ones that we cultivate in meditation. But more importantly, I think, it's from those moments that we're afforded the best opportunity to be able to make different judgments, to make different ethical and moral choices. Because this is a state of clarity, a state of clarity that can enable us to see more precisely, more truly perhaps, you know, what's actually going on in this moment itself. So this to me is the most radical difference between a secular and a religious approach in Buddhism, is that the goal of nirvana, it's not that the practice leads to the goal of nirvana, but it is the momentary experience of nirvana, of non-reactivity, that opens up the possibility of living differently in this world now. So, Dave, your turn.
All right, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Stephen, for that. I like everything you have to say, and I have for a long time. I just want to start with a brief story for a moment, because it's been so important to me, and that is what Stephen's talking about in many ways is what's known as the Four Noble Truths. Now, I've had a very confusing relationship with this teaching for about 30 years now. I remember first reading a book at Dan Goleman's house in the basement, and it said desire was the cause of all suffering. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense. And it was first, I think it was maybe 2008, Stephen, when you first did a talk at Gaia House about this reframing about actually to embrace suffering rather than to end suffering, which is where you started today, which changed the game for me, oh God, in 2010. That really relaxed me, because I worked so hard to end suffering, and I was never able to do it. And I felt like I was doing Buddhism wrong. And not only was I suffering, but I was actually not very good at it. I was suffering incorrectly. And if you've been there, you can imagine how frustrating that can be. So when we think about a secular dharma, this idea has been floating around in my head since those sets of talks, and I'll send out those sets of talks in the email afterwards. But for me, secular dharma, what we're trying to avoid, this is not a new set of dogmas, a new set of beliefs. For me, this is a dialogue. Secular dharma is an ongoing dialogue, hopefully a dialogue that does not come to an end. And there can be as many versions of a secular dharma for those who practice it. So we're not trying to develop a new set of beliefs, a new set of dogmas, a new set of doctrines, as much as we are trying to perhaps get away from all of that. And so having done podcasts on the topic of secular dharma for the last year, I've noticed one thing that's been interesting is talking to other teachers in the Buddhist space is everybody has a different understanding and a different feeling about this word secularity or secular. So I want to just talk about that a little bit, because I think hopefully you'll leave with a little bit more excitement about the term and a little bit more enthusiasm, because people have mixed feelings about it. And so the word secular does not stand in opposition to anything. It's not like either you're a religious person or you're a secular person. I would argue pretty much everybody on the screen, I don't see any shaved heads or brown robes, is that we are all secular people. If you don't live in a monastery, if you live in contemporary society, you live in a secular world, as Stephen pointed to, this time, this era. Many ways, it just means right now. You know, what is the world that we live in right now? And right now, I like how Stephen says, we're putting the world first. We live in a complicated world. A very confused world, a world where things like polarization is everywhere. People seem to be really dug into their ideologies, their views and opinions. And certainly we don't need more of that. So having a more open-minded approach to the practice can be very, very helpful. So it really, for me, what stands at the bottom of this is an attitude of tolerance. A secular dharma is an attitude where we're not so caught up in believing or clinging to views and opinions, but being open to ones that might actually stand in opposition to the ones that we have, so that way we can actually have a dialogue around these things. Another way to think about it that's been helpful to me is this notion that everybody seems to know about the Buddha taught a middle way. Even people who have no interest in Buddhism generally know that the Buddha taught a middle way. And the middle way is synonymous with the Eightfold Path. That's really what he was on to. And for me, I think a middle way is trying to find a middle way between science and religion, or science and spirituality, depending on how you hold those. Because I think it's safe to say that science clearly does not have all the answers. Science cannot provide us an adequate set of ideas or set of tools that lead to human flourishing, that lead to a really genuine, authentic sense of happiness. It's certainly helpful in many ways, but it doesn't necessarily do the heavy lifting, nor does religion. For many people, they find that it doesn't provide them, that believing in something doesn't actually really provide or necessarily turn us having an experience of real happiness and thriving and meaning. In fact, just as a side note, if you look at cognitive science research, the very cognitive act of believing, there's no evidence to suggest that believing in anything has any impact on the quality of life that you experience. And I think we can probably see many, many examples of this. And as Stephen has said many times before, is using this Four Noble Truths or the Four as not a set of truth-based claims, the truth of how things are in an ontological sense. This is the truth of how things work and we need to adhere, but really a task-based ethics. It's not trying to something that we know. It's something that we know how to do. You know, how do we navigate the complexity of this world? How do we navigate the climate, the politics, the social issues without getting caught up in having the right view? There's that word right. We could attack that word today, but I think we'll put that aside for now. It's about what you know how to do. And just to give you a few examples, it's like, you know, if you're in the Dharma space, if you've read any books on Buddhism and you've studied this stuff at all, it doesn't take very long before we get introduced to the idea of impermanence or anicca, that things are constantly evolving, things are constantly changing. There's no absolute. Everybody probably knows that. I know that. I believe that that's actually true. But knowing that isn't really that helpful to me when I'm faced with real change in my life. Somebody close to me dies. A loved one dies. I lose my job. I lose my house. I have friends in Los Angeles whose houses are gone. You know, I don't suspect anybody I know walked up to their house, burnt to the ground, and said, "Well, yeah, impermanence, things change." You know, of course this happens. And so the question is, how do we? Do you know how to adapt? Do we know how to meet change in a real way? How do we actually work with that in real time as it's emerging? Whether we believe or know that things change is a bit irrelevant. Just one more example, it would be compassion. I think most Buddhists would agree that compassion is a value that we aspire to cultivate. And probably many people have heard that, you know, compassion is the antidote to suffering and we want to meet all suffering with compassion and care. I have no problem with that. I actually believe that that's true. But when I'm confronted with real suffering, when I'm confronted with suffering of my own suffering, my family, my kids, people I care about, knowing that compassion is the right response, having that bit of information doesn't necessarily help me be able to actually really embody or to really bring compassion to that experience. And for me, it's very simple. Compassion is being able to be in that painful experience. This is really to embrace suffering means that I can be in touch with suffering without becoming overwhelmed by it. I'm not overwhelmed. I'm not falling apart. I'm not, you know, falling to pieces. It's not overwhelming me, but I'm also not disconnected from it either. There's another middle way for you. How do we embrace suffering without being overwhelmed and without being disconnected? And if you have a phone, if you have any digital device, disconnecting from suffering is actually quite easy. And so to me, that opens up this space that Stephen's talking to in the ethical domain of nirvana or nibbana. Can I be in the complexity of experience? Can I be in pain? Can I be in anguish, whether it's my own or somebody else's, without becoming overwhelmed or without disconnecting from that? And that's a skill. You can't just choose to do that. You know, that's something that we have to work for. It takes time. It takes effort. It takes practice to do that. That's a very difficult thing for most people to do. The other way I like to think about a secular perspective, so there's that word perspective, is again trying to zoom out and seeing it as a both and, which is not, you know, it's not either or. You know, life is, we know this, and we learn about this in Buddhism all the time. Life is both tragic and beautiful. It's not one way or the other. You know, how do we celebrate? How do we embrace the, it's not just also about embracing suffering. I think it's also about embracing the beautiful. It's about embracing joy. It's about embracing it all. As Stephen's saying, you know, suffering in the widest perspective possible, the biggest frame possible. How do we be able to embrace the width and the depth of our humanity, that which is both beautiful, that which is tragic, and trying to have this perspective on things that's very realistic, that's really much about this life, about what's going on in the day-to-day struggles, the day-to-day joys of my life, which, you know, as we all know, mindfulness practice is very much about this, about being tuned into the body, being tuned into the feelings, to the mental states, to the ideas, the thoughts, all of it, really trying to live our life one moment at a time, as we know that's how it unfolds. And so there's some basic principles that we talk about in a secular dharma that I just want to highlight, I think, that are helpful, is that in many ways the goal of a secular dharma would be to really improve the quality of life for everyone on the planet, or even I would extend that to all beings on the planet. How do we have an inclusive thing where the goal is to try to improve this quality of life for all beings? And again, if we are going to put our stock, or if we're going to trust anything, it's probably at this day and age best to trust science and scientific thought and scientific inquiry. Now, I say that is not a rejection of religious views or religious values, but it's trying to really understand that we do know some things, and we have to take science seriously. And also, too, as we know with the emergence of mindfulness and all these practices, there's a boatload of evidence to suggest that the cultivation of mindfulness is, in fact, good for you. And then also, you know, this one that I like is it's good to do good. You know, it's good to do good. It's about goodwill. It's about kindness and tolerance and generosity. And these ideas that I think are universal through almost all religious thought, these basic ideas. One thing about this that I think is interesting is, for those of you who have studied Buddhism, it's quite a big, gigantic universe and quite complex. But one thing that I've noticed, and Stephen can tell me if I'm wrong, but one thing that I've noticed around Buddhist teachings is, whether it's the early Theravada or Mahayana or later schools of Tibetan Buddhism, one teaching that seems to get elevated and all traditions really point out as being very valuable, they have different names for them, but that is what's classically known as the Brahmaviharas. You won't find too many, as much as Buddhists don't agree on everything, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any school of Buddhism that would kind of try to talk you out of these qualities of kindness, loving kindness, metta, compassion, care, equanimity, gratitude, appreciation, that these are really, and when I say that it's good to do good, it's that it's this cultivation of the heart, of these values, these qualities of really meeting the world with a place of kindness, being kind to people that I don't agree with, being able to be friendly with people who hold opposing views and attitudes than I do. That's a skill. I've had to work pretty hard to learn how to do that. Is to be able to see that if I value kindness and I come into contact with somebody, what's more important in that moment, me being right and having the more correct view, or me just being kind and just being friendly? And I find that I practice with this every single day. And so we can really see that this is a kind of universal teaching in the Buddhist space, I think, that really fits well here in terms of that. Lastly, just a few things that I'll add that Stephen doesn't mention so much in his work, mostly because I think it's not something that he's done. But one of the things that I've noticed that's been helpful to me is bringing secular ideas or secular practices to the Dharma. And so what I mean by that is I'm somebody who, I have a 20-year history of sobriety, so I've struggled with addiction, alcoholism, and other debaucherous forms of behavior I'll politely leave aside for now. Struggling with addiction, also with trauma. I lived most of my, almost my entire teenage years, I lived in a highly state of PTSD, and much of my adult life it was also true, that I've actually had to go above and beyond just Dharma practice. I've been involved in 12 steps, and I found that to be very transformative and very helpful. I've also been involved in different forms of therapy, trauma therapy, different types of psychotherapy, different types of practices that have really helped me with that. And I think when we talk about suffering, real good grass-fed organic suffering, we're looking at things like addiction and trauma and the way that these things impact people. And I've had to look outside of the Buddhist box. And so as I look into the world of psychotherapy, different therapeutic modalities, especially now in this day and age, the world, modern world, the secular world is a treasure trove for different models, different ways, whether it's EMDR therapy or Gestalt therapy or cognitive, there's all these therapies that are really, really helpful to help us embrace suffering, to help us to heal. And it's also interesting that those therapies, which I've engaged in, have also enriched my Dharma practice in a very, very meaningful way. In fact, nowadays, when you find a form of therapy that has efficacy, they just park the word mindfulness-based in front of it now. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy was really effective. Now it's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Relapse prevention in the addiction space, a lot of efficacy. Mindfulness-based relapse prevention. So there's a way in which we can not just have a secular approach to the Dharma, but we can use modern ideas, whether it's philosophy. I mean, Stoicism is coming back in a huge way. These ancient philosophies are really making a big appearance in the world. So how can we not just kind of reduce everything to a box of a set of teachings and practices, but really expand in a way that's meaningful? So that's one of the things that I've done in my work is not just having a secular approach to the Dharma, but bringing other things into the practice to expand and to alter and to just make the practice more meaningful, which actually will now bring me to question number two, and I'll go first, and I'll let Stephen reflect on this as well. And that question is what I just kind of mentioned, is how can a secular approach expand, alter, or challenge our practice in a meaningful way? And I think this is a good question. And just to kind of continue what I was just talking about, there's a number of things happening right now, I think, that are important to just kind of name that are happening in the secular world. The first is that we are now seeing people are unhappy, people are isolated, people are polarized. Addiction is actually increasing, not decreasing. We have a growing rate of people who just feel like life is not meaningful. In fact, there's a guy named John Vervaeke who has a series of lectures called Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. And I do think that we have a crisis of meaning, especially young people. They look at the world, they look at life, and they think there's nothing in this for me. And we see suicide, we see addiction, we see trauma, we see all of these things increasing. And that's happening in the secular world. That's happening in the world that we live in today. We also see that there is, with that comes this massive mental health crisis that we see. I know that we see it worldwide, but in America where I live, growing numbers of mental health. Even though we have these great medications and we have these great therapies and we have all these great tools to address that, we are not doing a very good job of that, and that people are really finding, addiction, incarceration, death is happening. How do we embrace that in a meaningful way? Also, another thing that's happening with that is we see an ongoing interest, and this has been going on for a long time, and it's getting more and more popular, a conversation between cognitive science and Buddhism. you know, a conversation around like for someone told me, I was reading somewhere, there was more books sold on Stoicism in the last year than there were in the last 100 years. You know, people are really turning to these ancient philosophies, whether it's Buddhism or Stoicism or Greek, people are really becoming interested in different approaches to to deal with the fact that life is feeling meaningless. And the overarching thing I think that's really interesting that brings into this, that really ties into a secular dharma, is we see, 10 years ago, Time Magazine, on the cover of Time Magazine was a pretty white lady, and it said, the mindfulness revolution. And we see that in the last 10 years, probably even more so than that, the popularity, the widespread popularity of the practice of mindfulness has made its way on, it's on the magazine rack at your local health food store. And I've interviewed Joseph Goldstein and Mirabai Bush and other people who were part of this emergence. And I asked them, did you ever think mindfulness would get to the level of popularity it has? And they usually laugh when I ask that question. And they go, no way. We never thought in a million years that mindfulness would reach the level of popularity. And so why is that? I think all of the things I just mentioned, I think they're all connected. And I think that people get kind of cagey around mindfulness. Of course, there's secular mindfulness. We could talk about that to some degree. But I think the popularity and the widespread popularity of mindfulness is only a good thing. And to be critical of that, I think, is foolish. There's been books written about McMindfulness, and there's been kind of this way in which Buddhists, actually, it tends to be the religious Buddhists who tend to be suspicious and skeptical of mindfulness and as it's taught in a secular domain, which I think is been kind of a mistake. So the other thing I would say is, how can this challenge? I think that a secular dharma, if done well, I hope that what we're talking about today challenges you. I think that challenging our ideas and our beliefs is very healthy and important. One of the tensions that I currently sit with, and that I sit with often in my teaching, because I teach in various different spaces. I teach in traditional insight spaces. I also teach in therapeutic places. Is that with all of this, the question for me is, how do I stay rooted in a Buddhist tradition without being stuck in that tradition? I really feel a big boatload of gratitude and reverence for the insight tradition that has come down through Spirit Rock and IMS and Joseph and Jack and Sharon and even Stephen, I put him in that category, is that I feel very grateful and very happy that I've been part of that tradition. And I think there's a lot of value in being involved in a Buddhist tradition because we have to be rooted in something. We have to be rooted in some set of practices and some set of theories and some set of philosophies that we can spend periods of time, perhaps even years, reflecting on those. But I also don't want to be stuck in those traditions. There's been times where I felt stuck in those traditions, mostly because I felt if I'm an insight teacher, if I'm a teacher of Theravada Buddhism, then I'm expected to some degree to actually buy into some of these ideas, which always never felt comfortable for me. I always felt uncomfortable, even though we're told to, Ehi Pasako, come and see for yourself, and don't take it until you've seen it to be yourself. But when you've seen it to be true, you'll realize that we have all this all sorted out for you already. And so a way in which we can have, there's a term for it, Stephen hopefully will mention it. He mentions it in some of his books. And I think the goal of a secular dharma, with being rooted in a tradition and understanding a tradition, but not being stuck in that tradition, is becoming independent of others in the teaching. Becoming an individual, becoming autonomous, having internalized enough of the practice through your own lived experience, through your own cultivation of meditation, so that way you can practice in a way that you don't get bogged down by these ideas and you don't feel stuck in these kinds of traditional ways. So I think if your practice is challenging you, if some of the things we're talking about today is confusing or upsetting in many ways, I actually hope that's the case. Because I think when we look at the Buddha's, suggestion for us was to cultivate this Eightfold Path. Again, that's the middle way. And that is to bring the practice of meditation, the practice of the Dharma, into all areas of our life, everything, our views, our perspectives, our imagination, our thoughts, our voice, the way that we talk, the way that we live, how we survive. And when we really do that, the Eightfold Path is not this set of doctrines on the wall. It's actually something that we want to embody. We want to become this Eightfold Path. And I do find it a little bit odd. Hopefully Stephen will fix or correct some of this for us. There's actually not very many books on the Eightfold Path. If people ask me that all the time, like, oh yeah, like the Eightfold Path, like what should I read? What should I get? And I'm always just like, really, I'm like, gee, weirdly enough, even though it was his primary suggestion, there has been little written on the topic from what I have noticed. So I think that's a lot for me. I'm going to pause there and put Stephen back on the pin and see what he might have to say or correct or any of those things. So thank you, everybody, for your kind attention.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'm really on board with pretty much everything you say. And I must admit, I think you articulate it very well. And I think to me, that's very, very encouraging to see how us oldies, as it were, you didn't use that word, but basically the generation of those of us like Joseph and Mirabai and others who went out to India in the 60s and 70s. And then we came back and we started teaching and opening centers and all that stuff. It's, to me, I think the best vindication of those choices that I made more than 50 years ago now is in the fact that there are younger generations of teachers like you, Dave, and others who are now coming through and taking what we've done further. I'm not at all interested in having disciples or followers who will read all my books and then work out some kind of view that I supposedly project and hold, and then will teach that for the rest of eternity. That, I think, is absurd. But on the other hand, there's a few points I'd like to pick up. I'm aware, in fact, the passage I started reading out to you from which I made my last remarks, I was aware shortly after having written that I had lapsed into speaking in very binary terms, very dualistic terms. I was saying, well, the religious Buddhist X, the secular Buddhist Y, and drawing out these differences. And I'm uncomfortable with that. On the other hand, I recognize that the language we use, all human languages, are built in such a way that these kinds of oppositions are grammatically very useful. If I want to understand something about anything, really, then it's often very useful to say, well, what we're talking about is this. We're not talking about that. In other words, there is certainly room in any kind of discourse for some kind of back and forth, some binary function of language that helps us think our way through to what is hopefully a more useful perspective. And Dave mentioned the idea of the middle way. Well, if you apply the idea of the middle way to what I was talking about earlier, then is there perhaps not a middle way to be found between a secular approach and a religious approach? Why do we think we have to choose one or the other? Could it be that we can be deeply religious, secular people? Why would that be a contradiction? And I feel that in my own life and with many of my friends that I've known over these years, I think it's almost impossible to locate anyone I know in either camp. As Dave said, we're all secular people now. And as Buddhism comes into our world, and as we struggle to make sense of that world, perhaps what the Dharma will provide us with is our strategies whereby to get out of that very opposition in which I've been framing at least my own presentation here. And I also completely agree with Dave, whereby a secular approach is not just about trying to secularize Buddhism or to take out the more religious and metaphysical bits and come back to some kind of core that seems to be somehow more accessible to us. But also a secular approach to Buddhism means that we draw from the secular world itself. The examples that Dave gave were very much taken from the world of therapy, of trauma, of mindfulness-based therapies and so on, and to bring in the skills and the understandings that the people in healthcare and in different areas of medical work have enabled us to make use of in such a way that mindfulness is somehow translated into not just a secular approach, but we are incorporating into Buddhism, our Buddhist practice, ideas that come from outside Buddhism. And this, again, is nothing new. The same thing happened when Buddhism went to China, it went to Tibet, went to Japan. On all of these occasions, Buddhism both gave what it brought from India, the Dharma, but it also received. It listened to what people were concerned about. It became aware of other approaches in, say, Taoism or in Tibetan shamanism or whatever. And it then brought that to bear on the Dharma. And in that case, a conversation emerged. And it's that conversation, I think, that is crucial. This back and forth, which again has its binary dualistic elements, but I think in the end allows something entirely new to potentially emerge. In my own case, as Dave correctly pointed out, I haven't been so involved in the therapy world, but I have been very much involved in the world of literature and arts. And I have learned an enormous amount from secular literature, from novels, from poetry, from short stories, from documentaries, from movies, from film particularly. I mean, I spend a lot of time, I go to the cinema at least two or three times a week, and I watch what are usually called art films. But I find that many of this these cultural expressions communicate and amplify and illustrate Buddhist ideas, but in a much more concrete way. And I feel that in many senses, Buddhism that has come down to us remains very abstract, and in that way, somehow remote. When you ask what suffering is, for example, Buddhism will give you a very good definition. It will list, you know, the eight sufferings and the three sufferings and this, that, and the other. But it rarely actually focuses in on the highly specific suffering of a particular person. And I think a very good example of this that we find in the Pali Canon, it's a very rare occasion, is a story where Gautama and his attendant Ananda were visiting a monastic community somewhere in India. And they entered a lodging to find that the monk who lived there was lying on the floor, neglected, in a pool of his own urine and excrement. And so the Buddha and Ananda, they bathed the monk, they cleaned him up, they lifted him, put him on a couch, and then they went off and talked to the other monks, and the Buddha said, well, why are you not taking care of this guy? And they said, oh, well, you know, he can't really pull his weight in the community anymore. We've got other stuff to do. He'll get better. It's okay. And then Gautama reproached them for having failed in their obligations, in their compassionate need to respond to the suffering of one of their fellows. And he made this very, very, very telling statement: whoever would tend to me, he said, should tend to the sick. Now, in identifying himself with the pain of that one particular monk, shows that for Gautama, to embrace suffering is not to do so in a very sort of abstract way. Yes, I embrace birth, sickness, aging, and death. But is what we're really called to do is to embrace the specific distress of a particular person that needs to be overcome. And so rather than treating suffering as just a general characteristic of existence, here we find an account where Gautama is responding to the actual pain of a particular person. It shows that he's someone who's willing to get his hands dirty. He's willing to muck in to a very messy everyday situation in life. It takes him down from his pedestal as a wise, saintly figure, to reveal him as a practical, caring man who deals with what has to be dealt with in the here and now. He becomes basically like a hospital orderly. I think for a lot of Buddhists, this story is slightly troubling, because the idealized Buddha is very difficult to imagine behaving in these kinds of ways, you know, with the shining golden body and the beatific smile and all that. And so in these kind of stories, and these are the kind of stories we find in novels, these are the kind of stories we find in movies. In other words, we get a much more granular sense of the specificity of dukkha. So when we're inviting, when we're embracing suffering, we're actually embracing a situation that is highly specific and needs to be responded to in a situationally appropriate way. It doesn't always have to be responded to in the same way. And that, I think, is very, very key to what a secular Dharma is about. So we have all of these ideas, therefore, about secularity and Dharma somehow getting into an operating exchange, an operative exchange with one another. And I feel that this is what our secular world can bring to Buddhism, and I think what Buddhism can bring to the secular world is a way to deal with the specificity of suffering in a way that's hopefully wiser, hopefully more compassionate, and ultimately also hopefully more effective. The other thing that Dave mentioned at some point was how secular Dharma is not particularly interested in setting up another set of doctrines, another set of dogmas, or as I mentioned earlier, I'm not interested in having people who just read my stuff and then come up with another point of view. That is, on the other hand, if we're going to think of ourselves as part of a community, as part of a movement, a way in which the Dharma, which has been going for 2,500 years, begins to find another form or another voice, I do think we have to somehow organize this perspective in a coherent way. And I've come up over the last few years with exploring what I call a cartography of care. A cartography is like a kind of a map of care. And care, I think, is the core value in the Dharma that encompasses and includes all other virtues. The Buddha's last words, for example, were things fall apart, tread the path with care. Care was the last word he used before he died, which I think gives it its centrality. And when we look and try and unpack this central notion of care, we find it presented as an elephant's footprint, a footprint in which all the footprints of the other animals in the jungle can be put inside. Care is like that encompassing perspective on life in which our practice unfolds. But very often, I think, we lose sight of that. And we lose sight of the fact that care is made up, in fact, of these four tasks of embracing life, of letting reactivity be, of seeing it stop, of cultivating a path. And each of those four phases, those four tasks, include a particular sets of virtues. I'm not going to get into that now. But all in all, you can then begin to map that into a kind of cartography in which there are 32 virtues divided amongst four tasks, four ways of responding to life. And amongst these virtues, we find something else that Dave brought up quite centrally, is the idea of the Eightfold Path. And in my first reflection about when we started, I already made the point that for a secular Buddhist, nirvana is not the end of suffering, but nirvana is the beginning of another way of living in this world. And if we put that in more traditional Buddhist language, nirvana therefore becomes the source of the Eightfold Path. Moments of non-reactive awareness and mindfulness, if it's anything at all, mindfulness is about the cultivation, a systematic cultivation of a non-reactive attention to the world. And it's by cultivating that non-reactivity that we actually open up and expand the experience, the nirvanic experience that is already here and now. Nirvana is not something reserved for the spiritual elite. Nirvana is an experience that all of us already know, maybe very, very peripherally, maybe not very deeply, but we've all had moments in which we've experienced a still, quiet, silent attention, whether it's in meditation, whether it's walking in the mountains, doesn't really matter, but we kind of already know. And that's the point at which our path begins, and the Eightfold Path then begins to unfold. Now, one of the metaphors the Buddha uses in the suttas when he describes these 32 virtues is that they need to be cultivated in the same way that a chicken cultivates the eggs that she has laid. So the metaphor he uses is one of a hen sitting on a nest, and as the hen does what the hen does, she will move with her feet the different eggs that are beneath her, and the ones that have sort of got a little bit too far out of the center and are getting a little bit cool, she'll maneuver them back into the center of the nest so that all of her eggs are kept equally warm in such a way that they'll enable each of her chicks to hatch safely. Now, once you think about that metaphor, which I think is an amazing metaphor, it's a metaphor of giving birth, it's a metaphor of breaking out of what's, in a sense, containing you into another kind of life. But what also happens with that metaphor is any sense of there being a sequence in the Eightfold Path, you know, right view, right speech, right this, that, and the other, that breaks down. There is no sequence in a clutch of eggs. There's no first one, second one, third one. They all get moved around. And the point, therefore, is to what I think this suggests is to get out of this idea that a path will necessarily and rather mechanically go from step one to step two to step three to step four to step five. All Buddhist traditions order the sequences of the Eightfold Path in exactly the same way. In other words, it starts with right view, ends with right concentration. And this metaphor, I think, challenges that. And I think for the kind of world we live in now, we are invited, I would say perhaps encouraged, to rethink the structure of that path in such a way that it meets the kinds of needs for which are primary for us today. So I would suggest, and I'm not going to say anything other than just list these things, that today the Eightfold Path for many of us is not going to start with our view, it's going to start with our practice of mindfulness. That is so often now the way that people are introduced to this path. Whereas traditionally, mindfulness is at the end of the path, mindfulness and samadhi or collectedness. I would suggest we put them at the very beginning of the path. And they are what, it's that mindful attention and awareness and focus that then enables us to cultivate a more stable perspective, which is what I prefer over the word view, a perspective on life, which becomes the foundation for a much richer imaginative life, imagination usually being mistranslated as intention. It's got nothing to do with intention. It has to do with being able to picture and imagine how we are going to resolve a particular problem here and now. How do we imaginatively come up with a solution to that problem? This then leads us into a life of application and effort. It leads us into finding a way of life that can support us, that support our family, the what is usually called livelihood. And this can then also inform and give rise to meaningful work. Work not just as labor, as doing things as we have to do them, but meaningful, creative, constructive work in the world where we're working as a doctor or we're working as a therapist or a meditation teacher, whatever it might be. But this is a primary source today of our finding of meaning in our life. It's through our work. It's through writing, in my case, making art, that I find meaning and value. And yet work, survival are treated as marginal elements within traditional Buddhism, which for the most part is the kind of Buddhism that is best suited for monastics, not for people living in the world. And the final step on the Eightfold Path in my current iteration would be voice, finding one's own voice, becoming, as Dave mentioned already, independent of others in the practice. And this, I think, has a lot to do with how we actually express and articulate in our own words, in our own forms, the values that we most deeply admire. It's also entirely true that despite the importance of the Eightfold Path in Buddhism, there are very few, if any, books that are dedicated just to that one topic. There's one by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is published in Sri Lanka, which is good, but it's basically just a kind of collection of sutta passages on the Eightfold Path. I think one of the crucial challenges for a Dharma of our time is, in fact, to rethink an Eightfold Path that is adapted and suited to our needs. And I think I might have at least made a step towards this in my next book. This is a crass promotion. My book will be published. The book is called Buddha, Socrates, and Us. It'll be published by Yale University Press in August this year. And it will have two chapters, chapters 27 and 28, which are devoted to a rethinking of the Eightfold Path, but done according to a very different secular template as opposed to the way in which you'd be most used to hearing about it. And I'm going to stop there. And Dave, your turn. I think we're now going into questions, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I'm going to add a pin here. I'm going to stop the recording for the questions because I think that people ask better questions when they don't know they're not being recorded. So I just do a few shameless self-promotions before we do that. First of all, thanks for coming. We're going to do this again next month. You will get an email from me because you signed up through Rizuku that'll have some links to some things that we talked about, the audio, the video, and also a link to I can put it in the chat right now, the Secular Dharma Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that me and my wife operate. These events are offered freely, but if you want to make a donation, you can do that. If you want to support Stephen, I suspect the best thing to do is to check out Bodhi College. If you want to learn more classes and more stuff that's going on, Bodhi College has a whole bunch of classes and online things that are just really, really great. And if you put questions up, we'll try to address them. Next month, we'll bring Jay Michelson. Some of you might know Jay Michelson. He's a good friend of mine. Him and I are going to further unpack some of the stuff that Stephen and I talked today by doing a lecture called Realistic Dharma. And that is, what do you really think you're going to get out of this? Come on, really. And so he and I will reflect on that. And you can sign up for that course here in the chat as well. And so let me stop here.